Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thanks for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast, bringing you philosophy for our times. Here at the IAI, we're committed to taking philosophy out of dusty books and lecture halls and into the heart of public life. If you enjoy this debate and want to carry on the discussion, or watch over 1,000 more debates and talks on all the latest issues in philosophy, science, politics and arts, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.
Thank you very much and good morning. Wonderful to see you. It's 50 years, and I regret to say I do remember it, since the second wave of feminism got going, and time to reflect on where we are. So we've got progress in some areas. We've got more women in Parliament. We've got more women in the boardroom and a handful of CEOs. So even the BBC is lumbering towards better gender balance in its representation. But what has budged at the same time is the gap between elites and the rest of us. So you've got a gap equally between successful women and less successful women. So the question we're going to look at this morning is whether that gap, whether the success that feminism has had in penetrating the elites, is perhaps bad for sisterhood. Is there solidarity? Is the success of an elite group of women good for all women or not? Are female care workers and CEOs really still on the same side? And to discuss this, we have an eminent panel, beginning on my far left with Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a distinguished professor of law at UCLA. Her books include Mapping the Margins. She's an expert on race and gender, an expert on many things, actually. To my immediate left, Margaret Hefferman, entrepreneur, one of those successful CEOs turned author. Her book, Willful Blindness, was Financial Times Business Book of the Decade, which is pretty impressive. And to my right, Miriam Francois, who is a political commentator, theorist, and broadcaster, focuses on Islam and feminism and the Middle East. So I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say on the subject. And I'm going to ask them to begin. Miriam, perhaps you could begin to tell us, to address the theme of the debate in 4 minutes, sisters and sisterhood in 4 minutes. Is sisterhood
bad? Are the female elite threatening the sisterhood? I would probably want to start out by unpicking a lot of the terms in that. So who gets to define who this elite are? How are we defining success? Are we taken over now within discourses on feminism by ideas that are being defined by a global capitalist system, according to which essentially the measure of someone's worth is their productive capability within this broader system, and the extent to which that comes to define our priorities within feminism. So the elite are these quote unquote successful women running big companies and earning lots of money, but essentially you could flip it in another way and say they're part of a very small elite that requires the exploitation of a large number of people, male and female, in order to accrue an increasingly significant amount of wealth towards an increasingly small number of people. And so I'm not sure that they'd be my elite or my notion of what would be success. And then when it comes to the notion of sisterhood, I find the term a little bit fluffy personally. I prefer the term solidarity, which I think has much more implications for notions of mutuality, accountability, and recognitions of common interests. I would even want to unpick the notion that women as a category are necessarily bound by shared experiences. I think even within the same societies, women experience very different versions of quote-unquote equality or inequality, prejudice. And so it's therefore difficult to talk about shared struggles in any meaningful sense without looking at the broader power relations within which individual women find themselves. And so more finally, to just maybe end on this note, I'm not personally that interested. I'm not saying it's an irrelevant discussion. I think it's important to talk about the struggles of like the 1% of the 1%, but I'm probably much more interested in the extent to which the 1% of the 1% are contributing to deepening, worsening economic precarity for a large number of people, male and female, and amongst that group of men and women who have very different experiences, it should be said, and that the developing world or the global south is very differentiated. It shouldn't be presented as one group. But within that, women tend to suffer the hard wedge of it.
I think that's a no. Margaret.
Well, I guess, you know, in theory, I'm part of this elite, right? Because I'm a woman, I've been a CEO, I have, in conventional corporate terms, been very successful. I'm extremely unhappy about that. I was reflecting before we came in this morning of an experience I had when I was a senior executive producer at the BBC, and my boss put his arm around my shoulder, because you could do that in those days, and said, good old Margaret, she's one of the chaps. And he meant it as a compliment, and I think at the time, I probably took it as a compliment. And I can also remember when I was working in the United States, I was running VC-backed software companies, my lead investor, thinking I'd been off on vacation because he'd completely failed to notice I was pregnant. So I was clearly doing a fantastic job of being a guy. And I have to say, this doesn't fill me with pride, it fills me with horror. Because I think the truth is that as marvelous as it is to see women at the top of organizations, the cost is very high. I think the cost is fundamentally, not always, and with differing degrees, but nevertheless, the cost is one of assimilation. And, you know, to be absolutely honest, I didn't come into business to maintain the status quo. And I didn't want to get the power to run organizations to perpetuate the status quo. I always thought the whole point of being a marginalized outside group was to come in and shake things up. And I still think that. I still think that the way most of our organizations are run is inept, unkind, unfair, cruel, wasteful, and unproductive. And I think that those of us who are on the outside probably see that more clearly than those who are on the inside. I also think trickle-down doesn't work in any context. It doesn't work economically. It doesn't work in sport. Having a couple of Olympic athletes has not increased sports participation or the health of the nation. And trickle-down doesn't work when it comes to women, to ethnic minorities, to any marginalized group. Having a couple of figureheads at the top, it's great having the role models and saying it can be done, but it doesn't move, it doesn't redefine the norm in any meaningful way. And I think we also experienced that under Mrs. Thatcher, who was, you know, a role model of female leadership that was highly assimilated to male norms and did absolutely nothing for women. I think this target of 30% of board members being female will do nothing to change the way our corporations are run or managed. I think we need a much deeper, more grassroots movement if we're going to effect any change. And I'm absolutely mortified and disheartened by the fact that billions of pounds have been spent over the last 20 to 30 years on diversity campaigns in schools, in corporations, in the NHS, in institutions, and we've seen virtually no change at all. So I don't think focusing on the top is going to get us to where we need to go.
Kimberly.
Well, so I think we're going to have a challenge finding an area for debate, so we're going to have to look for it, because Miriam and Margaret both said exactly some of my sentiments trickled down. Feminism doesn't work. I would include trickle-down. Anti-racism doesn't work. And I would also say that some of the terms of the question actually bear some interrogation, namely the idea that we are in a period of feminist success. So success defined by what? The idea that we have a sisterhood that we may lose. When did we accomplish that sisterhood? And the remaining inequalities that might be left behind being framed as something other than gender inequality. That's also something I'd want to question. So I guess to try to complicate it a little bit, I'll say that much of the work that I've been involved in is to elevate another way of thinking about feminism, another way of thinking about sisterhood. I frame it as intersectionality. And so I've been looking at some of the assumptions that underwrite how we tend to think about feminism. One assumption is that the universal woman is unmodified, a woman without a race, without a class, without a gender expression or sexuality. That woman, when she achieves equality, then we don't have to worry about gender inequality anymore. But it turns out that there is no such thing as a universal woman. There is no such thing as woman unmodified. And the problem is that so many laws, so many of our campaigns tend to assume that there is such a thing. So in the context that I know about American law, one of the consequences of that was that when black women were raising questions about employment exclusion, discrimination, many times courts didn't pay attention to their demands because white women were actually employed. So there were jobs that were appropriate for women, but they were only jobs that white women could actually be appropriate for, like secretaries and front office jobs. And because black women experienced something different, many times courts would say, you didn't experience gender discrimination. You experienced something else. But that something else wasn't just race discrimination, because those women couldn't get jobs that were appropriate for black people either, because the black jobs were for men. Those were, you know, industrial jobs. So the point is that when we assume that feminism is only about a universal woman, we miss all the ways that women experience gender discrimination. Sometimes they experience it as women of color. Sometimes they experience it as women who are queer. Or sometimes they experience it as women who are working class. So all these inequalities that are seen as being left behind are not just left behind because there's something else. These are gender experiences as well. So as I see it, the real question is, can we use the notion of sisterhood to develop a more robust vision of feminism, one that is capable and critical of some of the ways that patriarchy expresses itself across a whole range of differences?
The themes obviously change, but I think that structurally this discussion has been going on for a long time. It's going on for 5 decades, and it may have been framed differently, you know, in terms of the priorities that you needed to advance in order to get to feminism. So I want to just go back a little bit and ask you each to think about the question of what feminism is actually trying to achieve. If you had a feminist society, what would it look like? Or what, you know, what right now would you think was feminism's biggest job? What's it aiming at?
I see the struggle for feminism as part of a broader struggle for equality within society. And so my utopian feminist society looks like an egalitarian society in which there is a mutually defined set of norms in which one gender, one ethnicity, one power group in society hasn't had a monopoly over definitions of, I mean, in this case, we're talking about success, for example. I'd link it a little bit to the discussion that we're having about sort of glass ceilings and the worlds of CEOs. I mean, the extent to which we measure, and you touched on it a little bit, female success on a male spectrum, and the extent to which we continue, I feel, to believe that if we just manage to do the same as men and play down the extent to which our femininity is a problem, quote unquote, it's still being viewed as a problem, then we are failing to dismantle the broader sort of framework in which our femininity is constructed as a problem. And so I would not really be a big proponent of this idea of we need to break through the glass ceiling, for example, because the glass ceiling is what men have defined as success. And even when I read things, I mean, I have some sympathy for some of the most prominent CEOs. I don't want to pick one out, but one in particular that's written quite a famous book about her experience of encouraging women to, what's another word for lean in?
Lean, I think.
No, well,
I think who that is.
Not sure. Anyway, the idea that actually if we as women just do more, that somehow we'll get to where we need to be. And I read this and I just think, I actually want to do a lot less. I really do. I really would love to do less. And I'd love for men to do more. And I'd love them to do more of the in the spheres in which despite all these advances that show that men are doing a little bit more housework and a little bit more childcare, that ultimately it's still that the division of labor is still so strong that there are two spheres in which we continue to dominate the terms, and they dominate the terms in the public sphere. Maternity leave, the extent to which we have mentoring programs, I think all of these seem to me like piecemeal solutions that are attempts to limit a broader cauldron of discontent with the system itself.
So essentially, you see, what feminism is trying to achieve for you is a completely different society, more egalitarian. It sounds a little utopian, but.
Well, I think to the extent to which we're talking about ideals, yeah,
Is that what you think feminism is trying to achieve?
Funny you should mention that, because later today I'm giving a talk on feminist utopias. And I think...
You have a blueprint for it?
Well, I could probably summarize it. for me, you know, the utopian vision of feminism is the elimination of the social articulation of sexual difference. It should be that when you look at me and you can see that I have female sex organs, it doesn't mean anything to you. You can't make assumptions about whether I'm, you know, smart or stupid, rich or poor, empathetic or logical. You don't, just all of those kind of stereotypes and assumptions can't happen. And there's a really delightful, you know, book written by the American feminist Charlotte Perkins Gilman called Her Land. And it's a fantastic sort of utopian fantasy in which is about a country that's run completely by women. And there's small details that most women will appreciate, like all the clothes have pockets. You know, this is a great leap forward, let's face it. But, you know, the fundamental point that she's making, and it's a serious point because she's a serious thinker, is that if women ran the world, the society would start at a different place and offer different things, different opportunities, and a different way of living and being than the world we currently inhabit. That the world would not start from a position of power, competition, and struggle. It would start from a position of love and fairness. And that the kind of fundamental principles of parenting become the foundation of social order. Now, to me, this is a much bigger idea of feminism than 30% board representation or a little bit more paternity leave.
It doesn't stray back into gender stereotyping in any way?
Actually, it doesn't. What's really funny about it is, you know, into this all-women world, land are sort of catapulted three male explorers who challenge all these stereotypes, and they keep making assumptions about how it won't work, because women aren't practical, you know, and can't organize themselves and so on. And the so the stereotypes keep being exploded. And one of the guys, who's the narrator, starts to realize that actually everything he thought about as feminine doesn't make any sense in this world, and it's only defined as feminine by men. And it's a really beautiful, subtle observation. The point is that this is a society which, you know, I think speaks much more to Miriam's values about ideals and egalitarianism and freedom.
Which you would plan to achieve, or in your view, feminism would achieve through achieving a kind of gender blindness that you started out with.
Well, I don't think it's about gender blindness. I think it is a society in which your anatomy doesn't say anything about you to anyone else.
But is it a receptiveness to it, though? Because to me, the concern with gender blind models is the same concern with like the idea of the ethnically blind models. Like, actually people do see difference, and actually maybe true equality comes from recognizing difference, acknowledging it, but being mutually respectful of that difference. Whereas the idea generally in my view of blindness is the superimposition of what tends to be, you know, white middle class values onto other people's notions. Yeah, well, it's one model that is presented as neutral and universal, but isn't actually, and speaks to one group's experience more than others. Yeah.
So I just want to bring Kimberly in on the question of what, for you, feminism is trying to achieve.
Well, you know, once again, I see us troubling the conversation starting from what world it is we want to create, as opposed to what we don't like about this particular world. So I struggle with the beginning from a utopia, because I do think that this particular conversation, do we want a gender blind world, or do we want a world in which what has been associated with gendered female consequences, personalities, is actually no longer the mechanism for disempowerment. So what does empowerment look like is somewhat of a different question from what does it mean to upend the gendered order in which everything that's framed as female in this binary, it's not just a binary, it's a binary and a subordination. So I start from that point and ask, what are the aspects of our contemporary world that we would not want to carry into a utopia, which is a little bit different. So I look at a range of social moments and say, where is gender playing a role in distributing burdens, negative consequences, life, altering responsibilities on those who are gendered as female? What would it mean not to have that happen? So that for me is number one. And number two is taking that analysis not as a universal, but integrating it into all of the movements that we actually now have. So for me, when I think about what kind of world I want one in which when we march, for example, against state-sanctioned violence against people, it's not just men that we're marching for, we're marching for women as well. I want a world in which when we fight against gender-based violence, we're not just advocating for women who are victimized by domestic violence and private forms of sexual violence, but for women who actually have experienced sexual violence at the hands of police. Now that's an entirely different way of thinking about some of our traditional issues, but we only get there by looking at all of the issues that we have and ask, how do those who are gendered as female experience this? Right. So some of the work I do is on a campaign called Say Her Name in the U.S. Everyone knows about Black Lives Matter, but they don't know that many women have also been killed in the same circumstance, or many women have been sexually abused and actually raped by police officers. It doesn't enter into our conversation about feminism because we imagine feminism only as taking place between men and women of equal status or in the same communities. We don't see feminism as implicated in the state's relationship to communities of color. So for me, my feminism is more or less, what kind of tools can we have in the here and now to help us think far more inclusively about questions of not just gender, but gender as relates to race, gender as relates to religion, gender as it relates to class.
And poverty.
Yeah, well.
Do you want to hear more from the world's leading thinkers? The answer to that question is yes. Subscribe to IAI.tv for unlimited access to thousands of debates, talks, articles, academy courses, and live events. Are you bored of the surface-level news, politics, sports, and entertainment coverage on your newsfeed? Go deeper. Get the philosophy behind the news and get the latest big ideas from the world's leading thinkers on subjects at the core of the human condition, life, the universe, and everything in between. It's free for the first month. And there's no commitment to pay, so subscribe now to understand the world beyond the surface level.
To some extent, we have a notion of where we want to get to, and that is, you know, to put it rather simply, a much better world in terms of values, in terms of measures of success, in terms of tolerance, not just between women and men, but in race and class and so on, which is perhaps, I think I detect bits of utopia in both of your approaches, whereas Kimberly, you're much more concerned with the here and now and the imbalances of power in movements that already exist and how one should correct that. So I just want to kind of go on a bit with the question of how we get there and this question of elites and non-elites, because Margaret, you talked about having been a member of the elite and feeling that the price of that, if you like, was subordination to elite values and therefore no change. So the question of whether breaking the glass ceiling really matters at all, or whether it advances anything. But Kimberly, you're talking about at every level there are movements which have embedded, you know, prejudice and oppression of women. So that doesn't really seem to get us anywhere. So I just want to just ask you, Kimberly, to start with, you know, how important breaking the glass ceiling is, that theoretically you get women into positions of power. Surely they must. That must be a good position to change things.
So I go back to Margaret's point that trickle down. Social justice just doesn't work. It doesn't mean that it's meaningless. So just for a second to shift out of gender to race, when Barack Obama was elected to the president of the United States, that was a glass ceiling shattering moment. It was meaningful, but it was meaningful at the level of whether racial outsiders can ever achieve and rise to the pinnacle of American authority. That was meaningful for him and for people who are symbolically invested in that. But in terms of its trickle-down effects, the only thing that happened politically in the United States is that the only black senator moved to the White House, right? It didn't really change the structure of race in the United States, and I would imagine the same thing happened here when Margaret Thatcher became
not a noted feminist in the conventional term. Oh, sisterhood was not
so it basically just tells us that shattering ceilings really won't do the work of deconstructing patriarchy or race throughout society. It is a move within the elites to diversify who is elite, and sometimes it might have some trickle-down effects, but that really depends on the policies that are put in place by the people who are actually able to break those glass ceilings, right? So it's just to say it's not an axiom that breaking the glass ceiling actually does anything. It's also not an axiom that it does nothing either, so I'm not on the side of nothingness. I'm on the side, that's the moment where, if there's a such thing as sisterhood, one has to see it expressed in actual policy, in using power to do things within the limits of what the structure will permit. And we don't really know what those limits are, because many times to actually get there, so much has been sacrificed that you can't really, you know, test how much would possibly be possible, what could happen.
But Miriam, given, you know, I think there's a conundrum here. We talk about elites as, you know, powerful bodies that essentially shape the world. So surely penetrating those elites matters in terms of the kind of changes you'd like to bring about.
I think women who are in those positions are in a double bind, in as much as we already heard, to some extent you have to play down the idea of your womanhood in order to access those positions. You know, we hear about CEOs who, you know, bounce back after 6 weeks. No, no one bounces back 6 weeks after having a child. You decide that, you know, the cost of not going back is too severe for your career. Like, I don't necessarily believe that these are the kinds of choices that we would be making as women if we were truly powerful in the sense that I understand powerful in those positions. And the other, so the double bind is that you've had to play down your femininity to a large extent to acquire that position of power, but then once you're there, you're somehow expected to represent all women. Well, no, you can't. Like, first of all, you can't represent all women anyway, because we all have, we're bound up in, I think, and maybe they will come to this, but quite conflictual relationships, even amongst ourselves as women. We have differing interests. The interests of a CEO of a big fashion company are quite different to the interests of a woman in a factory in Bangladesh. And therefore, to suggest that once she's acquired this breakthrough via, you know, breaking down this glass ceiling, that somehow that's a success for all women worldwide is preposterous. I mean, it's a ridiculous notion. But I do think it's important for us to focus on the extent to which there are inevitable contradictions between the success of some women and the oppression of other women, and therefore not to be too overjoyed by these examples of capitalist success, which are presented as examples of universalized as examples of female success. And I did want to point out that there are also issues with the notion of solidarity between women in different contexts, that feminism can act as a form of imperialism when the cultural contexts of other women aren't properly understood. And we see this a lot when it comes to quote-unquote solidarity with Muslim women in the Middle East. I mean, I forget the number of times where I've gone and spoken to women in different countries who refuse to identify as feminist, even though in my mind they quite clearly are feminists, because for them feminism is experienced as a cultural colonial project. It's imperialism in another guise. In other words, it's an attempt to impose one usually white woman's understanding of what emancipation looks like on another woman. And when you're talking about usually a very secular context, that is a problem for example, women who identify as religious, be they in the Middle East or elsewhere. I mean, that's not the only issue. So yeah, just to throw that in.
Margaret, you did break through the glass ceiling, and you did express your disappointment at your failure then to change the world. I can't think, you know, you had...
I'm still working on it.
8 hours a day, you know, 5 days a week, why not? Yeah. So would you, if you were doing that again, or if you were giving advice to the, you know, the next wave that's going into the trenches, would you say that was the way to go, or how would you advise them to work if breaking the glass ceiling isn't it? What should they be doing?
Well, I'm really interested. I think for women in very large established corporations, the opportunity to change things is tiny, minuscule. I see women doing, you know, some women doing a much better job than others. I think that's great. But I think really the capacity for change is tremendously limited.
How does this feel? Well, the cult of the CEO, you know, yeah. CEOs are paid gazillions of pounds because they are supposedly magical beings who come in and transform an organization. That's why they're paid in, you know, Pantechnicon loads of gold. So why can't a woman who goes in do that?
Well, you know, there's a reason they call it compensation. Mm. I think, you know, the experience of most CEOs is they're pulling on levers and there's nothing at the other end. I mean, that's a whole different ball of wax, as it were. But what really interests me is I wrote a book about the rise of female entrepreneurship. And I interviewed hundreds of women who, significantly driven by rage and frustration, left these companies and went off and set up their own organizations. And they did that overwhelmingly because they thought, there is a different way to work and I can't make it here, I can make it if I do it from scratch. And what is really striking about these organizations in all sorts of different industries and areas and so on, is they definitely are better places for women to work. They turn out to be much better places for men to work too, because women are actually much more demanding about their expectations of the workplace. And if you satisfy women, you satisfy everybody, right? Because we just have much higher standards in terms of how we want to live and to work. And, you know, to me, studying this cohort of 10.6 million businesses in the US was probably the most optimistic thing I've done. Because this is about 46% of the American economy. And they were at least creating different kinds of workplaces which treated people in a different way, paid them in a different way, thought about the relationship between the business and the community that it served in a different way. And I think, you know, personally, I think that building that sort of, what I think of as a sort of parallel universe, is more hopeful than trying to change these highly patriarchal organizations from within. Now, is it enough? Of course it's not enough. And I don't think that, you know, totemic symbols like the female CEO of a Fortune 100 company or even a female COO of a Fortune 100 company is an indicator of change throughout the system. It clearly isn't. And the fact that if you're paid a couple million dollars, you can get to the top, well, gee whiz. You know, anybody paid a couple million dollars is going to find life a lot easier than if they're being paid about $7 an hour. So I think, you know, I think you're exactly right, Kimberly, which is, you know, there is an intersection of feminist subordination with economic subordination. And if you're really a feminist, you care about all of the places at which that intersect. I don't think you can just choose your quadrant.
So would you say that entrepreneurial capitalism, grassroots capitalism, is a more effective agent of change than social movements, political movements?
No, I would not say that, but I would say that I think it is a more effective means of change than trying to change these large corporations from within.
Because they enforce conformity so rigidly.
And the cost of plowing your way up the hierarchy is so enormous that by the time you get there, you're either exhausted, cynical, or male. You know, really. Because, you know, the psychic burden of assimilation is enormous. You know, you so subtly pick up language not to use, issues not to raise. I mean, I don't know how I managed to be pregnant for 9 months and nobody noticed, but clearly my body language was amazing, you know, because I kind of just made sure I didn't upset anybody. Now, I didn't consciously want to do that, but clearly, unconsciously, that's what I achieved. There's a cost to that. There's a real psychological cost to being so good at fitting in that you don't stand out.
But then, given that every institution is male-dominated and therefore, I guess, has a culture which is shaped around the male psyche, you could say the same about getting the top of anything, university.
And you should, because it's probably the case.
So we shouldn't be trying to do that.
Well, you know, one of the things that in the academy sometimes provides is the space to do the alternative within the walls of the academy. So, I mean, let's think about it. Feminism is that. Feminism in the academy was made possible by the fact that there were women in the academy who were clear that the traditional disciplines did not provide the critical lens for thinking about how gender actually is expressed in society. So it becomes a different school of thought. I'm part of a group called Critical Race Theory. We do the same thing. So the challenge isn't just figuring out whether you're in or you're out, but if you are in, what are the spaces that are available to create a counter project or counter way of doing the work while still maintaining the basic sort of performance that you need to be in that space. So a lot of us do precisely what you were suggesting. We figure out how to mentor in ways that are actually more responsive to some of the needs of non-traditional academics, non-traditional workers. We figure out how to evaluate work based on a different set of principles than the ones that have traditionally been used to create the discipline and so on and
right.
so forth. So I think that part of what might be seen as feminist practice but not actually articulated as such is the way that women in a whole range of institutions have tried to figure out how to furl in, how to be a part of, how to be part of an underground railroad, to use another frame, in order to not only establish a beachhead, but to also have that as a point of entry and sustenance for other women who are also coming in.
I think I sound, and I think all of us sound, you know, incredibly pissed off, disappointed, and pessimistic. I do think, to what you've just said, that what I've seen in the last 20 years in terms of the creation of women's networks, an expectation that women will help other women, I think this is a great leap forward. I think it is an underground railway. I think that's exactly the right metaphor.
Are we allowed to call this sisterhood?
I don't care what you call it. I mean, is it sisterhood? Yeah, I suppose it is. I mean, I'm probably prouder of the young women that I have mentored who've gone on to build their own organizations or of who've had fantastic careers when previously they were languishing in pretty crappy jobs, overlooked and underpaid. I'm probably prouder of them than any fancy titles I've ever had.
Right.
Because I think that's the job, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And on whether it's sisterhood, I'll just say, sisterhood is always fraught, right? So, exactly. So it's not a matter of it's a kumbaya moment at all times. Their sisters can, you know, really go at it in ways that can be very devastating. I think the question is whether normatively we want to present for ourselves a set of expectations that we then hold each other to.
So looking at where we are and this, where we started from, which was the sense that, you know, women are getting to the top more, but this gap nevertheless between, because of the structure of society, the relationship of elites to the rest, the gap between women is getting wider. Do you see that as something that's set to continue?
Well, it's not just that I see it, it's that global trends tell us that inequality is on the rise, and therefore inequality between men and women, well, on a global scale, the concentration of wealth in an ever smaller number of hands is a trend. So, I mean, that affects men and women, but disproportionately affects women. So I mean, I don't know if your question was about optimism, but what I would say is we're bound up in very complex realities, and so every individual woman in her context has to apply solidarity to the extent that is possible within the limits within which she found herself. And therefore, that's why I'm generally reluctant to criticize other women who define as feminist, particularly publicly, because the reality we're confronted with is complex and it's full of barriers to this utopia that we've discussed. So, for example, I mean, we couldn't really have a discussion about feminism without mentioning Beyoncé, so I feel like we should. But, you know, Beyoncé, to me, has done tremendous good as a feminist model, whilst at the same time being a very contested feminist model. So on one hand, you know, I don't know who else in pop culture could, you know, go to the Super Bowl with symbols of the Black Panthers and have white America celebrate this, and also have as one of her most popular albums, images of women who'd lost their sons to police violence. So taking marginalized voices and putting them back to the at the center of popular culture through her art. That to me is part of that feminist struggle that we're talking about. At the same time that the video came out, there was this controversy that her new sportswear range was employing factory workers in Sri Lanka who were being paid
nothing at all.
You know, yeah, exactly. So these bounded realities right. that we're confronted with. So, but we have to, I think, acknowledge the successes where we see them and be open to criticism from
sisters. Highly symbolic figure in some ways. But there are other ways of changing things. If you go, I mean, in a social democracy, if you go to to Scandinavia, for instance, you find the whole atmosphere is different because there are, you know, tend to be half the government is female and, you know, you meet senior officials who are just as likely to be women. It feels differently and they have more progressive social legislation and all that sort of thing. So there are, it's not necessarily true, is it, that the gap needs to go on getting wider?
Well, so my initial reaction when I hear the experience of some of the Scandinavian countries is just the question of, does their relative lack of racially distinct others make that more accessible for women? In other words, when we live in hierarchies that are deeply shaped by long-term historical race projects, does it amplify difference such that it's harder to make the claims that tend to be made for precisely those kinds of socially democratic experiments? I mean, in the U.S., one of the main reasons why poor and working class women were pushed out of the social safety net was because stereotypes that were attached to particular racialized women actually became a problem for all women. Namely, black women had been elevated as the women who were more likely to just get on the dole in order to have children. It was long-standing racial stereotypes that A, weren't true, but B, actually applied to all poor women. So when people think about, do we use our tax money in order to equalize motherhood, what's in many people's minds isn't the wife that they have, but that other woman around the corner or down the block. So race actually played a role in suppressing a feminist possibility of far more robust state support for right. motherhood.
Thank you for listening to this Institute of Art and Ideas podcast. If you enjoyed this debate and want to carry on the discussion, visit iai.tv. Remember to subscribe and review on iTunes.